She looked over her shoulder at the door, but Helm crossed to it and turned the key in the lock, slipping the key into his pocket. She knew she must show no weakness in front of these two, and though she was tired and afraid and her bladder ached, she feigned an air of confidence and assurance and crossed to the nearest chair. She pulled it from the table and sat down in it easily. Nogor looked up at her and frowned. He had not expected her to react this way. "You know the Shufter bandit, Mechnimer?" he accused abruptly.
"No," she said coldly.
"I know the patriot and democratic leader, Mechnimer. He is no Shufter." "You are his concubine, his whore. Of course you will say this." She looked away from him with disdain, and his voice rose shrilly. "Where is Mechnimer? How many men does he have with him?" Her composure was beginning to rattle him. She ignored the question, and Nogor scowled at her furiously. "If you do not cooperate with us, I will have to use stronger methods to make you answer my questions," he warned. She turned in her chair and stared out of the window. In the long silence that followed, Jake Helm crossed the room and went to the door behind Nogo that led through to the rooms at the rear of the hut. He disappeared through it and closed it behind him. The walls of the hut were thin, and Tese made out the murmur of voices from the room beyond. The cadence and inflection were neither English nor Amharic. They were using a foreign language in there. She guessed that Helm was receiving instructions from a superior who did not want her to be able to recognize him at some later date. After a few minutes, Helm re-emerged and closed the door behind him without locking it. He nodded to Nogo, who at once stood up. They both came across to stand in front of Tessé.
"I think that it will be better for all of us if we finish this business as quickly as possible," said Helm softly. "Then you can go to the bathroom, and I can go to my breakfast."
She raised her chin and stared at him defiantly, but did not answer him. "Colonel Nogo has tried to be reasonable. He is bound by certain niceties of his official position. Fortunately, I do not have the same restraints. I am going to ask you the same questions that he did, but this time you will answer them." He took the dead cheroot from his mouth and examined the tip. Then he threw the butt into a corner of the room and took a flat tin from his hip pocket. From it he selected a fresh cheroot, long and black, and lit it carefully, holding the match to it until it was drawing evenly. Then, amid a cloud of pungent tobacco smoke, he waved the match to extinction and asked, "Where is Mechnimer?" She shrugged and looked away, out of the side window of the hut. Abruptly, without signalling the blow in any way, he hit her open-handed across her face. It was a savage blow, delivered with a force that snapped her head around. Then, before she could recover, he swung back again and slammed his knuckles across her jawline. Her head was thrown back violently in the opposite direction, and she was knocked flying from her chair. Nogo stooped over her and seized her arms, twisting them up behind her back. He lifted her back into the seat and stood behind her. He held her in such a surprisingly powerful grip that she could feel the skin of her upper arms bruising beneath his fingers. "I have no more time to waste," Helm said quietly, taking the burning cheroot from his lips to inspect the glowing tip. "Let us start again. Where is Mechnimer?"
Tese's left eardrum felt as if it had burst with the ferocity of those blows. Her hearing buzzed and sang. Her teeth had been driven halfway through the flesh of her cheek, and her mouth filled slowly with her own blood.
"Where is Mechnimer?" Helm repeated, leaning his face closer to hers. "What are your friends doing with the dam in the Dandera River?" She gathered the blood and saliva in her mouth, and suddenly and explosively spat it into his face. He recoiled violently and wiped the bloody mess from his eyes with the palm of his hand. "Hold her," he said to Nogo, and seized the front of her blouse. With one heave, he ripped it open down to her waist, and Nogo giggled and leaned forward over her shoulder to look at her breasts. He giggled again as Helm took one of them in his hand and squeezed out the nipple between his finger and thumb.
It was the dark purple colour of a ripe mulberry. He held her like that, pinching her flesh with his nails until the skin tore and a droplet of blood welled up and trickled over his thumb. Then, with his other hand, he took the burning cheroot from his lips and blew on the top until it glowed hotly. "Where is McNamara?" he asked, and lowered the cheroot towards her breast. "What are they doing in the Dandera River?" She stared down in horror as he brought the burning cheroot closer and tried to wriggle away from him. But Nogo held her firmly from behind. She screamed once, on an agonized, drawn-out note, as the glowing coal touched the tip of her nipple and the delicate skin began to blister. "Winter," said Ryan, spreading the enlargement of the fourth face of the stele from Taunus's tomb under the bright glare of the flood lamp. "This is the side that contains Taita's notations, which I am postulating are those of the bear board. I don't understand all of them, but by a process of elimination I have determined that the first symbol denotes one of the four sides, or, as he terms them, the castles of the board." She showed him the pages of her notebook on which she had made her calculations. "See here, the seated baboon is the north castle, the bee is the south, the bird is the west, and the scorpion the east." She pointed out to him the same symbols on the photograph of the stele. "Then the second and third figures are numbers. I believe that they designate the phial and the cup. With these we can follow the moves of his imaginary red stones. The reds are the highest ranking colours on the board." "What about the verses between each set of notations?" Nicholas asked. "Such as this one here, about the north wind and the storm." "I'm not so sure about those. Probably merely smokescreens, if I know Taita. He's never one to make life too easy for us. Perhaps they do have significance, but we can only hope to unravel them as we work through the moves of our stones." Nicholas studied her figures a while and then grinned ruefully. "Just think how remote was the possibility that anybody would ever be able to decipher the clues he left behind. The first requirement is that the searcher must have access to both chronicles, the seventh scroll and the stele of Taunus, before he had any chance of understanding the key to the tomb." She laughed, a throaty, well-satisfied sound. "Yes, he must have believed that he was perfectly safe. Well, we'll see now, Master Taita. We'll see just how clever you really were." Then, sober and businesslike once more, she looked up the stone staircase that led to Taita's maze. "Now we have to see if my figures and theories fit into the hard stones and walls of Taita's architecture. But where do we start?" "At the beginning," Nicholas suggested. "The god plays the first coup." "That's what Taita told us. If we start here in the shrine of Osiris, at the foot of the staircase, then perhaps that will give us the alignment of his imaginary bear board." "I had the same idea," she agreed immediately. "Let's postulate that this is the north castle of Taita's board. Then we work the protocol of the four bulls from here." It was slow and painstaking work, trying to work their way into the mind of the ancient scribe by probing the labyrinth of passages and tunnels that he had built 4,000 years previously. This time they moved into the maze with more circumspection. Nicholas had filled his pockets with lumps of dried white river clay, and he used these like a schoolmaster's stick of chalk to write on the stone walls at each branch and fork of the tunnels, setting out the notations from the winter face of the stele and marking a signpost to enable them not only to find their way through the maze, but to relate it to the model that Royan was drawing in her notebook. They found that their first assumption, that the shrine of Osiris was the north castle of the board, seemed to be correct, and they happily believed that with this as the key, it would be a simple matter to follow the moves of play to their conclusion. But these hopes were soon dashed, as they realised that Taita was not thinking in the simple two dimensions of the conventional board. He had added the third dimension to the equation. The stairway leading up from the shrine of Osiris was not the only link between the eight landings. Each of the passages leading off from it was subtly angled either upwards or downwards. As they followed the twists and turns of one of these tunnels, they did not detect the fact that they were changing levels. Then suddenly they re-emerged onto the central staircase, but on a landing higher than the one that they had entered from. They stood there and stared at each other in horrified disbelief. Rohan spoke first.
"I didn't even have the feeling that we were ascending," she whispered. "The whole thing is infinitely more complex than I first assumed."
"It must be constructed like one of those nuclear models of some complicated carbon atom," Nicholas agreed with awe. "It interlinks on all 8 planes. Quite frankly, it's terrifying."
"Now I have some inkling what those extraneous symbols signify," Rohan muttered. "They set out the levels. We're going to have to rethink the entire concept."
Three-dimensional Bayo played to enigmatic rules. "What chance have we got against him?" Nicholas shook his head ruefully. "What we really need is a computer. Taita wasn't puffing his own virtues without good reason. The old hooligan really was a mathematical genius." He shone the lamp back down the tunnel from which they had come. "Even when you know it's there, you cannot actually see the fall in the floor level. He designed and built it without even a slide rule or a spirit level in his back pocket. This maze is an extraordinary piece of engineering."
"You can form your fan club later," she suggested. "But right now, let's start grinding those numbers again.
I'm going to move the lights and the desks up here, onto this central landing of the staircase," Nicholas agreed. "I think we should work from the centre of the board. May help us to visualise it. Right now, he's got me thoroughly confused."
The only sound in the room was the soft sobbing of the woman, who lay curled on the floor in a puddle of her own blood and urine.
Tuma Nogo sat at the long conference table and lit a cigarette. His hands trembled slightly, and he looked sickened. He was a soldier, and he had lived through the Mengistu terror. He was a hard man and accustomed to violence and cruelty, but he was shaken with what he had just witnessed. He knew now why von Schiller placed such reliance on Helm. The man was barely human. Across the room, Jake Helm was washing his hands in the small basin. He dried them fastidiously and then dabbed at the stains on his clothing with the towel as he came back and stood over Tessa.
"I don't think there's anything else she can tell us," he said calmly. "I don't think she held nothing back."
Nogo glanced down at the woman and saw the livid burns that spotted her chest and her cheeks, like the running ulcerations of some dreadful smallpox. Her eyes were closed and her lashes were frizzled away. She had held out well. It was only when Helm had touched her eyelids with the burning cheroots that she had at last capitulated and gabbled out the answers to his questions. Nogo felt queasy, but he was relieved that it had not been necessary to hold her lids open, as Helm had ordered, and to watch as he quenched the flame of the cheroot against her weeping eyeballs.
"Watch her," Helm ordered, and he rolled down his sleeves. "She's a tough one. Don't take no chances with her."
Helm walked past him and went to the door in the far end of the hut. He left the door open, and Nogo could hear their voices, but they were speaking in German, so he could not understand what they were saying. He understood now why von Schiller had chosen not to be present during the questioning. He obviously knew how Helm worked. Helm came back into the room and nodded at Nogo.
"Very well, we're finished with her. You know what to do."
Nogo stood up nervously and placed his hand on the webbing holster at his side.
"Here?" he asked. "Now?" "Don't be a bloody fool," Helm snapped. "Take her away, far away. Then get somebody in here to clean up this mess."
Helm turned on his heel and went back into the rear room.